It's Thursday, August 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, banned weapons may have been used in Syria.
This is the longest range I think I've ever seen in Nodong fired to. I mean, they fire it from near the west coast of North Korea.
Another missile launched by North Korea, this one landing near Japan. Also ahead, financial markets on an uncertain direction. And Nine Lives pairs two great actors on the big screen. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Both the government in Syria and the opposition are trading charges of using chemical weapons after reports surfaced Tuesday of civilians being treated after a toxic gas attack in rebel-held Idlib province. It is close to the site where a Russian helicopter was downed on Monday that killed five Russian personnel. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby said Washington is looking into the reports.
If it's true, and again, I'm not saying it is, but if it's true, it would be extremely serious. We've long expressed our strong condemnation of the use of chemical weapons on civilians, which of course violates not only the cessation of hostilities, but international standards and norms, including the Chemical Weapons Convention, to which the government of Syria is a member, as well as two UN Security Council resolutions, 2118 and 2209. So again, not in a position to confirm. We're taking it seriously, we're looking into it, and we'll see. Now, as you also, I think, know from prior reports of the potential use of I know you're not saying this was chlorine, neither am I, but you know the alleged use of chlorine, that the OPCW has the monitoring the responsibility for that, and those investigations can take quite some time to try to actually determine what happened. But obviously, it's a serious report, and we're certainly concerned about it.
In 2013, UN investigators determined that sarin gas had been used in an eastern province, killing nearly 1,500 people. The U.S. implicated Syria's government in that attack. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in Texas tells VOA's Victor Beatty that assigning blame is hard without independent verification of the various charges.
A top-level diplomat told me a few years back regarding the Syrian civil war is that there are two wars going on in Syria. There's the one real one with the people firing at each other and explosions and bombs and all that sort of stuff. And then there's the misinformation war. And the information coming out of Syria, I've learned to be quite skeptical of coming from either side. I take everything with a grain of salt, particularly because we really have very little, if any, on-the-ground reporting. And most of the information comes from organizations that clearly are anti-Assad. Now, having said that, are there still chemical weapons still being used? That wouldn't surprise me at all, either by the government or even by various opposition groups.
UN investigators 3 years ago said sarin gas was used in the eastern Ghouta region of Syria. The U.S. accused Damascus of that attack. Was that pretty well corroborated?
As far as I know, I believe it was. It appears that there definitely was a sarin attack at the time, and it appears that the Syrian government was responsible for it, you know, which is why I think it's easy to accuse the Syrian government of using, continuing to use chemical weapons and weapons which they really shouldn't have if all of them were eliminated following the U.S.-Russian brokered agreement.
The Syrian army, backed by Russian warplanes, are trying to prevent a new rebel offensive aimed at southwestern Aleppo, a vital city for both sides. Were you surprised at this rebel offensive and how strong it appears to have been?
A little bit surprised, again, because you know, the information we're getting is it seemed to be that the entire city was surrounded, and apparently was, and cut off the supplies, and that it was just a matter of days before the various opposition groups trapped in Aleppo would be, you know, starved out over time or surrender or something, as particularly as the Syrian government offered amnesty to rebels that would give up their weapons and other concessions. I think it's not all that surprising, however, that they're trying to regroup, that there be at least one last spasm of coordinated counteroffensive against the Syrian army and to try to reopen at least one passageway to get resupplies, particularly from the north and from Turkey. It's not a vice grip that the Syrian army and its allies have around Aleppo. There are many porous holes, and they're a very thin line because of resource and manpower problems with the Syrian army and even with some of their allies. So it wouldn't surprise me if the rebels at least temporarily reopen a corridor for resupplying, which they need desperately.
The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported Wednesday that regime forces backed by Russian air power recaptured key hilltops and villages on the southwest side of Aleppo. It reports dozens of dead on both sides of the conflict since Sunday. It's time now for our social media segment. And as always, our G. Abby Lee joins me right here in the studio with the trending story online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The big story on Wednesday is definitely hashtag Instagram stories. The photo and video sharing app launched a new feature which many people say resembles another social media app called Snapchat. And just like Snapchat, the photos and videos created with the Instagram stories feature disappear in 24 hours. But it also gives you the option to post them on the regular Instagram feed if you like. I know Snapchat is not as popular abroad, so to briefly explain what it is, it's an image messaging app where the content you share with your friends disappear in 24 hours. It also has different filters that people can use to transform yourself into different characters. I'm on there as well at The Gist with G. That's THEGISTWITHJE.
And I'm sure your account will last more than 24 hours.
I hope so.
So what's the public's reaction like to this new feature?
The uncanny resemblance was not missed by both the media and the public. Adweek and Gizmodo reported on it, and here's a top comment on Gizmodo's Facebook post. A Facebook user named Mike commented, "Instagram stories are exactly the same, except they don't have the cool filters and all that."
Well, we know cool filters are very important.
Very important.
I expect Instagram to have announced it on their Facebook page, too, since it's owned by Facebook.
That's right. It shared a sort of how-to video on its page that's been viewed more than 32,000 times and shared by more than 120 people so far. The top comment to that post reads like this. Facebook, you completely ruined Instagram with your quote-unquote algorithm. Stop trying to make every single social media network use an algorithm. It's not fun for any user, so stop trying to become Snapchat. Just bring back the original Instagram feed. Nearly 300 people liked that comment. That's all for me today. Back to you.
Well, thank you very much. I like that wrap-up, G. You may tweet your comments and questions to our Twitter stream at VOA_IE. You'll find myself and G on Twitter as well, at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending right now in Asia, Afghan forces say they have captured key Islamic State base. North Korea launches a missile into the ocean. Pakistani police say British woman strangled in apparent honor killing. Charity linked to terrorism tries aid delivery to Indian Kashmir. Australia accused of deliberately ignoring offshore refugee abuse. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. A medium-range North Korean ballistic missile fired Wednesday appears to have reached or come close to reaching Japanese territorial waters, a development that drew swift and strong condemnation from Japan and the United States. The U.S. Strategic Command said it was one of two medium-range Nodong ballistic missiles launched by Pyongyang from its west coast, with one exploding shortly after liftoff. Japan's defense ministry says the missile landed inside the country's 200-mile exclusive economic zone. South Korean analysts said the flight extended to about 1,000 kilometers. That's one of the longest for a North Korean test. RAND Corporation analyst Bruce Bennett tells VOA's Victor Beatty that only about half of North Korea's missile launches have worked, and that's not good news for the regime's leaders.
That said, this is the longest range I think I've ever seen a Nodong fired to. I mean, they fire it from near the west coast of North Korea, and that's in order to give them range as it flies towards Japan. So, yeah, they're proving their capabilities and demonstrating that at least some of their missiles ought to work. It demonstrates that U.S. bases and even South Korea are within range of this missile.
Troy Stangarone of the Korea Economic Institute says the likely international response will be the appropriate response at this point,
which is to condemn North Korea for its action, to go to the Security Council, and to take and try and put forward a presidential statement calling on North Korea to continue to refrain from taking conducting further missile tests. The challenge will be, as we all know, is that China, in light of most likely the THAAD decision, has been dragging its feet on the most recent presidential statement in regards to North Korea's missile activities. What we've seen over the years with sanctions is that even if Beijing does implement them in time, trade picks back up. Trade with the rest of the world over time does as well. One of the challenges is that North Korea tends to fall out of the lens of people over time, and you don't maintain the focus it is needed to take and convince the regime that even if they do test, that it will simply be a short-term loss, and that then things will go back to normal and they can continue on with their activities. I think when you look at the weapons program now, I saw that I think Tokyo recently also reached the conclusion that North Korea likely can take in place a nuclear warhead on a ballistic missile. That means we've seen that both from Seoul, from Tokyo, and the United States now. It seems to be a general consensus that even if their technology is unreliable, they likely can do that. The program has reached a point to where it is a real viable threat, and it does need to be addressed. And I think the pattern we've seen in the past to where countries perhaps impose sanctions for a slight period of time and then take and ease up as North Korea perhaps eases back on the test is not a pattern we can afford to go back into anymore.
The latest missile test comes as the United States and South Korea prepare for another round of military exercises later this month. The North has condemned such maneuvers as provocative and a prelude to invasion. Financial markets in the United States continue to be strong. The S&P 500 has snapped a two-day losing streak and settled at 2163 on Wednesday. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite finished at 5159, and its gains were slightly ahead of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which closed at 18355. Despite the day's performance, markets are searching for direction. We are too, so we turn to VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino in New York, where the Dow broke a seven-day losing streak, and there's some good things for investors to consider.
Yeah, there are some good things. And actually, today, equities made a small recovery in intraday trade as oil prices bounced and bonds sold off ahead of a few market catalysts over the next couple of days. Retailers brought down the consumer discretionary sector due to disappointing earnings and guidance from Kate Spade, along with cautious analyst calls on Kohl's and JCPenney today, which is not surprising because the trend has been over the past 2 years, I would say, Amazon is taking a ton of market share out of traditional brick-and-mortar department stores, and you also have competition from the discounters like TJ Maxx and Ross stores, and I think that's going to continue to be the trend for the retailers for quite some time as they try to figure out what the next trend is going to be in terms of keeping brick-and-mortar alive. Pharmaceutical companies also fell for a second day, led by Pfizer and Merck in the Dow. Financials fared the best among sectors, and energy names continued to bounce on earnings and the oil recovery. Now, the Dow has come into trade today riding a seven-day losing streak, but it's only down a little over 1.4% during that stretch. That's not all that bad. And even though we look at the market going up, 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 up every day as a positive thing, that's not always a good thing either because it makes it really hard to discern what the new buying opportunities are going to be. When you see markets that are in balanced by, you know, some good days, some down days. That's really what a true market is. When we see the market rebounding like it has since Brexit, for example, that's not exactly normal action either. So I think some of the corrective action, if you want to call it that, is a good thing. And I think we'll continue to remain range bound for the rest of trading today. The big thing traders are looking at next are the Bank of England rate decision tomorrow morning. That will be out before U.S. markets open. Essentially, traders are looking mostly for additional easing measures following the Brexit vote in late June. There's an expectation that we might see an interest rate cut for the first time in 7 years this week out of the Bank of England. So that will be that'll be something that we'll be focusing on. And of course, on Friday, the all-important non-farm payroll report data is probably the most important piece that we get each month.
We'll definitely be looking forward to that. I heard some analysts speaking that the range of trading was very narrow, the narrowest it's been in about 40 years. And the trading has been rather light, too.
It has been very light. There's a combination of things. I think we will continue to see this range-bound trade till we get through the employment numbers. Of course, the election, which is less than 100 days away, is going to be another variable that's out there. But you have to remember, too, we're in the middle of summer, and trade is typically slower this time of year. But I think a function of it is, too, when you see this range-bound, low-volatility trade, a lot of people just have cash on the sidelines, or they're staying out of the market until there's more clarity in terms of the direction.
And sometimes there's just an event that makes things happen. It turns, as they say, in a New York second.
Yes, yes, it does.
From New York, Jill Malandrino joins us each week. Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can keep up with all the latest at our website, voanews.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, check out Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. In the Netflix political drama House of Cards, Oscar winner Kevin Spacey plays a ruthless politician. But in the new film, Nine Lives, Spacey plays a father who has to win back his family's love or spend the rest of his life as a cat. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that Spacey is paired up with Academy Award winner Christopher Walken and also in the cast Golden Globe winner Jennifer Garner as they both help Spacey pull off this family comedy.
Kevin Spacey plays billionaire businessman Tom Brand, the head of the Firebrand Corporation and a man used to getting his own way. But that all changes when he has to pick up an extremely special birthday present for his daughter, Rebecca. Rebecca wants a cat. There's only one problem. Tom Brand hates cats. But he walks into a specialty store run by the aptly named Felix Perkins, played by Christopher Walken.
Look, I'm a little late for something, so we could just get on with it.
Meow.
Sure. You don't like cats, do you, Mr. Brand?
Look, can I just pick one out and then I'll be on my way?
You don't pick a cat. The cat picks you.
Look, I make million-dollar decisions for lunch. I'm pretty sure I can pick out a cat.
See that? He likes you. It figures because he's attracted to troubled souls.
Tom picks out a cat, but as he starts to go home, Felix puts a spell on him. Tom is in an accident and finds himself trapped inside the body of a cat.
How do I get out of this?
You haven't been there for your family.
When is Daddy gonna come home?
You have 1 week to reconnect with them, or you're gonna be stuck inside that cat for the rest of your life.
But I hate cats!
That's what makes this so perfect.
Spacey spends most of the movie as the cat, named Mr. Fuzzy Pants. The Oscar winner for American Beauty and The Usual Suspects did a lot of his work in a voiceover studio. When he was on set, Jennifer Garner, who plays his wife Laura, says Spacey helped keep the mood light, especially with his impersonation of co-star Christopher Walken.
He never wasn't doing a Christopher Walken impression, even when he was in a coma. And we were all crying around his bedside. We would say, Kevin, just be in a coma. We're trying to cry.
Melina Weissman plays Rebecca Brand. She says that Kevin Spacey was a joy to work with and to learn from.
I think just his personality, just like when the camera would cut, he would just start dancing and do some impressions. It just like he would just have fun with it, which was just such an amazing human being to have on set.
Robbie Arnell plays Tom Brand's son, David. He says working with Spacey on the movie was like taking an acting class.
And Barry said, you know, Chris, this is near the end of the movie. I want you to be a little happier and more energetic. And Chris goes, okay. Kevin needs to do impressions behind the camera, and Kevin just goes, yeah, okay, I can do that. So he started doing Johnny Carson and doing a bunch of impressions, and it ended with Kevin Spacey as Christopher Walken to Christopher Walken as Christopher Walken, and the whole world blew up.
Jennifer Garner says that audiences can look for a fun time, but with Kevin Spacey and Christopher Walken on the set, the movie earns its PG rating.
Well, you know, if Christopher Walken is involved, and if Kevin Spacey's soul is inside a cat, it's going to be spicy. So it's funny, but it's also really spicy and funny.
Directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, the man who directed the Men in Black movies, Wild Wild West and Get Shorty, Nine Lives also stars Cheryl Hines and Mark Consuelos. It's due for release in the United States August 5th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at our website any time of the day or night, voanews.com. Also, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and you can follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, and we had the double pleasure of having two engineers today, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman and Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day, and thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the United States Department of State issues its annual Trafficking in Persons Report, also known as a TIP report, which evaluates the efforts of 188 countries and territories, including the United States, to fight modern slavery. The purpose of this report is to enlighten, energize, and empower, writes Secretary of State John Kerry in his introduction of the 2016 report. By issuing it, we want to bring to the public's attention the full nature and scope of the $150 billion illicit human trafficking industry. Those countries with governments that fully comply with the standards fall into Tier 1. Countries that do not comply but are making significant efforts to do so are on Tier 2. The Tier 2 watch list includes countries that do not comply with the minimum standards, but are making significant efforts, but no more so than during the previous year, and have a significant number of trafficked persons. Finally, countries on Tier 3 do not comply with the minimum standards and are not making significant efforts to do so. Last year, 19 countries moved up in the tier rankings, while 27 were downgraded. This year's report focuses on successes in fighting modern-day slavery and what needs to be done to counter traffickers' tactics. Because even though governments have enacted new laws against all forms of human trafficking, are prosecuting traffickers, are protecting victims and empowering them to rebuild their lives, and have elevated public consciousness about this crime, there is still so much more that needs to be done. Still, if there is a single theme to this year's Trafficking in Persons report, it is the conviction that there is nothing inevitable about trafficking in human beings, writes Secretary of State John Kerry. Just because a certain abuse has taken place in the past doesn't mean that we have to tolerate that abuse in the future, or that we can afford to avert our eyes. Instead, we should be asking ourselves, what if that victim of trafficking was my daughter, son, sister, or brother? Secretary Kerry concludes this year's TIP report asks us questions, because ending modern slavery isn't just a fight we should attempt, it is a fight we can and must win.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.